Hi, and welcome to The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and this week, Hillbillies in the Holy Land. Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee is just back from American Friends Service Committee delegation to the Holy Land, learning about the situation in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel. Welcome back, Rick.
Thank you.
And with us, as always, is Lori Lynn, a columnist with the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Hey.
Hi.
First, I need to make a presentation, y'all, because, you know, some people may find this hard to believe, but Lori and I don't agree on everything. However, I am here to literally extend an olive branch.
Oh, wow.
And this little
olive branch, you can even
have a leaf, Scott, comes from the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus prayed on the night before he was handed over to suffering
goodness.
And death, saying, "Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." So there was this Franciscan who was, you know, trimming the garden, you know, and there are all these branches laying on the floor. And he goes, "Hey, don't you guys want one?" Said, yeah, because I was going to steal one anyway, probably, which would have been karmically complicated, probably, you know. The other thing, there's all these sites, you know, if you travel around the Holy Land, and some of them, you know, it's been kind of a business for centuries. So, like, there's one in the Old City, birthplace of the Virgin Mary. I wouldn't bet the farm on the authenticity of that one, but I'm pretty sure the Gethsemane thing really went down there, so.
You want to see a picture of Rick literally handing it the olive branch to Lori Lynn, go to our website, wvpublic.org. So you were talking about some of the impressions you had in, say, Gaza, of it being a place that's very hard to live.
We had to actually get permission to go into Gaza from the Israeli government. And just going through the massive checkpoint system there took several hours. And again, the browner my coworkers were, the more intensive their questioning. We had to go through three checkpoints, actually, one by the Israeli government, one by the Palestinian Authority, and one by Hamas. Gaza's been referred to as an open-air prison in the sense that, you know, airspace, they don't control it. The borders are controlled mostly by Israel or by Egypt in the very far south. Fishing is a big part of the industry there, and, you know, they're only allowed to go out 3 to 6 miles instead of the customary 12, so it's been hard. And the United Nations issued a report while we're there saying it might not be livable in 5 years. And here's the weird thing about it, just demographically. West Virginia, we have space, you know, and we have green. I really miss green. I mean, there's some green there. If I would take my goats and put them in a field there, they would just go on strike. Let me just tell you that. Well, the population there is 1.8 million, and the size is about 140 square miles. So think about that compared to West Virginia,
yeah,
where
that's
we
our
have
population.
Same population and about 24,000 square miles. So where there are people, they tend to be really crowded. A lot of people there were refugees from previous conflicts going back as far as 1948. There was rubble everywhere, destroyed homes and destroyed buildings, but also people trying to rebuild. And it's a place, you notice when you travel a lot in the developing world, you know, we're such a throwaway culture in this country. But there they were trying to straighten out rebar, every piece mm-hmm. of wood, every little thing that could be used to rebuild. But then the weirdest thing, like right after traveling through the destruction, we went to lunch and had a sumptuous feast, you know, up on the tower. And I've never had better fish in my life. And one thing that I think is really different for an American, we sort of have this love of the open road. I'm thinking about Walt Whitman's poetry, you know, "Afoot mm-hmm. and Lighthearted, I Take to the Open Road," or Kerouac, or Huck and Jim on the Raft, or Hop Woody Guthrie, Hop and Afraid, however you want to do it. And for a lot of people there, especially Palestinians, it's borders and checkpoints and lack of mobility. I couldn't even run when I was there, mostly because there just wasn't a place to do it. So that feeling of being confined is something that really struck me. And I know, you know, people have different perspectives on why that is or anything, but I'm saying that really got to me. And it makes me wonder how sustainable the situation is, because I think in general, life and nature likes to flow, and when you block it up too long, you know,
it's interesting you're raising that this week. I was reading this morning about the reimposition of border controls in a lot of Europe as a result of the refugee situation. When you think about it, you can probably drive in the U.S. thousands of miles without having to go through any sort of government checkpoint, you know.
And that's something, we have a lot of, you know, African Americans and Latinos. There are some of whom worked on the U.S. border, but it's just a different level of magnitude there. And mm-hmm. and again, if you're within, you know, the inner part of Israel, you know, and even if you're a Palestinian Arab citizen, you don't experience it to the same degree. Like one man who lived in a refugee camp near Bethlehem talked about, he actually snuck himself into to go to Haifa. And he was talking about how wonderful it was, because there, if you get pulled over, it's because you're doing something, you know.
Versus what you look like.
Yeah. You know, and again, there's all these checkpoints. So it's hard for people to visit family or to go worship in a certain place, or, you know, even going to work, because an 8-meter high fence could show up. And so I was thinking about, you know, a great American writer like William Faulkner, you know, who wrote in the South during the segregation time. Well, if you read his books, it's all about how, whatever you say, black people and white people are all tangled up in each other's business in a very intimate way, even when it was very unjust. And in some parts of there, there's not going to be a Faulkner. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then one surprise in Gaza, and I was only there in Gaza for like 24 hours or something. We got around to Hebron and Nablus and Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Ramallah, Jaffa, Tel Aviv, but we met with a group of people who actually wrote a book in English. They actually teaching English literature, and they talked about their love of American literature. And I think their particular favorites were Mark Twain, of course, and also Hemingway. I imagine Hemingway, if you're learning language and translation, Hemingway would be a pretty good one. But they love the story of the old man in the sea, you know, because of his tenacity. And a big word for Palestinians, and I have the Arabic written down, but I don't know it, is steadfastness. You know, this might be a hillbilly thing. It's this effort to try to hold on to the land and try not to be displaced and try not to be moved off of it.
An attachment to the land.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's often, you know, people often point, we used to live over there on the other side of that security fence. And, you know, so the thing that I wonder about is, again, is that a lot of these, I just don't know how sustainable this degree of tension is. I think, you know, in the 90s, they tried to reach an agreement, and the way the agreement would work, there would be, you know, a Palestinian government of sorts of some type in the West Bank and Gaza. And what it actually worked down, they got broken into three different kind of territories, you know, category A, B, and C. And A is all under Palestinian control. B is Palestinian civil control, but Israeli military control. And you can figure which one.
Which one dominates there?
And but like the Palestinian control is less than 20%, and the other one's about 20. So the much bigger area is directly under Israeli military control, which they call it civil administration, but it's not. And so, and something that often happens too is that's made that Oslo agreement kind of unworkable is that more and more settlements have been built in the territories, kind of pushing people out and making it impossible. So it's like, how do you? You know, imagine West Virginia if, like, you know, Berkeley County was in it and Logan, you know, and then maybe Parkersburg or something. Or to get to from the west side of Charleston to the east side, you had to go through Ripley and back, or, you know, things like it's just a. So one thing I think we're really lucky in America is, if for the most part, we don't have a lot of roadblocks. We don't have a lot of, if there's a roadblock, chances are there's a car wreck or a manhunt.
So describe some of the tense moments that you observed while you're over there, Rick.
Probably the place where I saw and felt the most tension. And I was in the Temple Mount the day before the disturbance was over there, and there was no sign of it. But again, things happen really fast. Like, we would be in one place, and suddenly you see a bunch of soldiers getting together, a bunch of armored vehicles. Like, uh-oh, something's going down. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew quite what. But Hebron was the place that was the most tense. In the Bible, it's the burial place of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Leah in the mosque, the Ibrahimi Mosque. And what happened there in the late 70s, a group of settlers came and occupied a building in the middle of the town and gradually displaced a big chunk of what used to be the heart of old Hebron. And these are a different category of settlers. They're very kind of aggressive and very in your face. They actually had to build a fence to protect the Arab marketplace from people throwing garbage and literal, you know, sewage and stuff down on the, you know, on the people below. And at one point, it was the noontime, and there was a call to prayer from the mosque. And there was one of the settlers was just blowing as shofar as loud as they could to disrupt the sound of it. And, you know, some people who were passing through were getting upset, but there was a soldier there to protect him. And apparently those kind of things happen in Hebron a lot. There's just a degree of tension there, probably higher than in other places.
Where are these settlers coming from? Are they people who have lived for a while in Israel, and then they migrate out to the settlements, or are they people who are coming to Israel from other places and choose then to go out into the settlements?
I think it's kind of it's a really mixed thing. I think some people are there for ideological reasons. Some people go because, you know, it could be cheaper and there's more government subsidies for people who who go there.
So it's not always ideological. It's not always let's go expand the territory.
That settlement there seemed to be particularly confrontational. I mean, don't take my word for this. Just look it up, Google something like that, and see what people say.
Well,
and
apparently, you know, there are thousands of French Jews right now who are flocking, you know, to Israel as a result of things going on in France. So, you know, that's still very much a reality of people from all over the world, Jews from all over the world.
From Brooklyn, from New Jersey, from all over. So that was just the most place I felt the most palpable tension. You know, and again, in other places, you know, maybe one reason why there's tension is where they actually see and interact with each other. And again, it goes back to that kind of apart thing, you know. And again, I'm not trying to, you know, take sides. I'm saying this is a reality there, and don't take my word for it. Just kind of dig around yourself and go there if you can. But I have some other stories. We talked to one person who lived in Ida, which is a refugee camp in Bethlehem. And in that society, having boys is something that's traditionally valued, but he said he preferred having girls because it's just so dangerous and scary to have a boy these days because they can be rounded up if something goes down, and kids as young as 12 can be tried in a military court. They can get up to a year, and kids a little bit older than that can get up to, I think, 8 years or something. There was some outcry about kids going to military courts, so they created a juvenile military court system. So they were scared about that. And also, you can tell a Palestinian house because there's water tanks on top because the supply of water and electricity is frequently cut out. And he talked about when his kids would travel outside of the area, like Israel proper to another country, when they asked how it was, they wouldn't talk about the scenery. They said, this was the best shower of my life. And again, let me just stress, I think this is a complicated historical event where people find themselves caught up in centuries of things, including people who've experienced horrible persecution in Europe, and then as well as people who feel themselves displaced and put aside there. So I'm trying to be as compassionate as I can all the way around.
To borrow from you, Rick, it's kind of a Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
And you can understand where people who are fighting for scarce resources, who feel either endangered on the Israeli side or trapped on the Palestinian side. Was there any hope at all about ways to de-escalate the tensions to break the cycle of violence?
Most people that on the Palestinian side there are obviously some exceptions, have a sense that acts of violence don't really threaten the system that they're concerned about. It kind of reinforces it and justifies more repression and things like that. So I think people are looking for other ways to try to conduct the struggle, including economic ways. And we even met with one entrepreneur who came back to Ramallah from the United States, and he's trying to build a thriving Palestinian economy there to the extent you can, but you don't control your borders, you don't control your airspace, you don't control the water supply, you know. And if you want to export agricultural goods and they close the borders for a couple of days, there goes your thing. And meanwhile, you're a captive market for stuff that, you know, it's just. So I think people are looking at economic ways of responding, you know, with, you know, targeting, say, companies that seem to benefit by the occupation.
Well, while you were gone, of course, Senator Manchin came out against the Iran deal after a long period of holding town meetings and thinking about it. Lori, were you surprised by that?
There was a really good Washington Post article you probably saw, Scott, about Manchin and his kind of the agony of his decision-making process. And it was interesting. He definitely seemed to be leaning toward it, you know, then obviously came to a place where he opposes it. Of course, it doesn't really matter that he opposes it as far as the practical consequences of it. But yeah, it was very interesting to watch him, you know, struggle with his decision.
And to do it publicly. I was kind of impressed with West Virginians showing up in large numbers to some of these forums to show that much interest in an issue that's so far away, I think, is unusual. We haven't seen that since the Iraq War. Of course, some people on both sides of the aisle are skeptical about his motives. You know, Rick, do you think that he changed his mind, or do you think that he just voted for the expedient thing once it was clear that the deal was safe anyway?
You know, I won't. You know, attempt to read his mind on that. I do think initially he inclined in favor of it. And I know he didn't come out publicly against it for a good while. So I don't know. It's sort of, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on following his leadings on that one.
Well, what do you think about the deal?
I would say that the deal in general, you know, opens up inspections and limits their capacity. And also, there's a snapback provision. If they don't think they're complying, you can cut out of it, you know, you can undo it right away. And there's nothing that – you're not locked into that forever, so –
I try to have a lot of humility in this kind of thing. You know, diplomacy is such an art, and I think the real question is, could we have done better? A lot of Republicans seem to think so. You know, without really getting into the nitty-gritty of it, I think it's just so hard to know. The one thing I will say is, you know, Cuba, which is something I understand a little bit better, I do feel like Obama, you know, was very, very, very eager to get that deal done. And it, that makes me kind of wonder if it was the same kind of situation. I'm in the unusual position of recommending Chuck Schumer. He has a very thoughtful, I think, statement on his website about why he ultimately decided that he would oppose the deal. And that, and the Schumer thing brings up another interesting point, which was also while you were gone, there was some discussion about the whole, you know, the New York Times had a graphic on its website showing how different, I think, representatives and senators had voted, and had a column that listed whether or not they were Jewish, the people who had opposed the deal. And a lot of people said, you know, this is crazy. How is this, you know, okay? And they ultimately took it down and apologized. But it was very interesting, you know, that the Jewishness of the representatives and senators came into it in such a prominent way, which, you know, on the one hand is understandable, but on the other hand, you sort of see why people kind of object to that.
I have a thought about just in general about the way conflict works. And when I think about the Iran deal, I think about game theory a little bit. And, you know, people have used it, you know, in math and in biology and in history and stuff. And, you know, the people looked at strategies. How do you deal with in a world where there's not a sheriff in charge? And, you know, one strategy that seems to work pretty well is tit for tat, which is where you start out nice. And then if they, you know, behave inappropriately, you respond. But then when they stop doing that, you lighten up too. And I think when you have a situation of really high conflict, if one side sends signals they'd like to dial it down a little bit, and you can dial it down a little bit too while still protecting your interests, that's the way conflicts get de-escalated in the real world. And the other thing, like shaming and humiliating people really study violence, think that's the virus that creates violence. There's a big difference between kicking somebody's ass and changing their mind. And
so interesting with the de-escalation, though. I mean, because on the one hand, obviously Iran really wanted this deal and was very seriously negotiating it. And on the other hand, you have the Ayatollah's Twitter account where he probably not him, but someone is tweeting, you know, very warmongering kind of statements. And I think there was a picture of what appeared to be Obama's silhouette with a gun to his head. And, you know, you can kind of see the difficulty, certainly if you're a State Department negotiator.
Yeah, I can see that.
With kind of American and world public opinion, when you have these kind of, and of course they're, you know, they're not targeted toward us so much as their own population, although they are in English.
I mean, I think the big question, and it's impossible to answer in advance, is do you oppose a regime entirely, completely with the intention to destroy them? Because they are so irredeemable that is the best thing to do? Or do you try to work with and rehabilitate them? And I think Iran is so tough because it's just not clear.
So let me just say, I felt like hitting tutors when I got back pretty hard, you know.
Yeah, Ray, you had mentioned earlier that you were all hummused out.
I don't even see
how that could happen. I don't.
I know. I didn't think so either, but I ran a serious chickpea surplus and red wine deficit while I was over there. And since I've gotten back, I'm trying to level the balance, you know. It's all about yin and yang, you know. Pork and alcohol are outlawed in Gaza, too, which, yeah, I'm glad I was just there for one night. Just saying.
Rick, we are glad that you are back, and we will have a link to your blog where you have some great stories and pictures from your trip, and you can check out that photograph of Rick literally handing Lori the olive branch on our website, wvpublic.org. This is The Front Porch. Thank you, Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee, Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, West Virginia Public Broadcasting has lots of other great podcasts, including Inside Appalachia. It is the award-winning podcast from Roxy Todd and Jessica Lilly that tells the true stories of people who live here. Check it out by going to our website and downloading Inside Appalachia at wvpublic.org. And thanks.